You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Elliot Forrest from WQXR and for Leonard Lopate today. There's a serious need for solutions to the problems we face in the 21st century: population growth that strains natural resources, climate change and pollution, emerging pandemics and drug-resistant diseases, and of course, economic stability and growth. Vijay Vaitheeswaran is the newly named, actually, China business and finance editor for The Economist, and he examines how innovation can tackle these problems and help everyone in the world benefit and prosper. His new book is called Need, Speed, and Greed: How the New Rules of Innovation Can Transform Businesses, Propel Nations to Greatness, and Tame the World's Most Wicked Problems. It's published by Harper's Business, and it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's a great pleasure.
Why do you think we need a new approach to innovation?
The problems that we have, these wicked problems, both abroad, the ones you talked about that are in some ways the seamy underbelly of globalization and Googleization. This wonderful era we've lived through that's brought great prosperity to many has also brought with us an interconnectedness that's leading to these deadly pandemics that are potentially emerging every year now. It's much more dangerous to be alive from the perspective of pandemics and superbugs today than even 30 years ago because of that interconnectedness. We're not ready for that. The problems we've been working on as a body politic, as a society, are the war on terror post 9/11 and the financial crash, really post Enron, post Lehman. These are difficult problems and they deserve our attention. Part of my argument is that if you look at things from the perspective of our grandchildren, they're actually not going to judge us on these problems because the really tough ones we haven't come to grips with. Political terrorism has been with us for over 1,000 years as humanity. If you look at crisis and capitalism, well, gosh, when was there not a crisis, right? Look at the South Sea bubble or the tulip manias. So the really difficult problems are the ones having to do with the megatrends of our century: the rise of China, India, and a billion more people lifted out of poverty into the global economy. That's a wonderful thing. But we know the resource pressure that's putting on the local environment, on oil resources and energy, and of course, climate change. I've mentioned the pandemics problem that's a result of our interconnectedness. We're in an age of where demography is shifting rapidly. So the world is getting much older long before everyone's gotten wealthy enough to afford being old. And with this come not only pension problems, but also chronic diseases. Just Alzheimer's alone could be a $1 trillion problem soon enough. And so I say these are these extraordinary wicked problems that demand an acceleration of innovation. We look at home and we see economic stagnation, malaise, a middle class squeeze. And part of my argument is that this age in which there is some wonderful stuff happening with new technologies, be that in genomics or big data, we see a convergence of these exponential technologies happening that offer the hope of a new golden age of innovation. But we're not connecting the good things that are happening with many people in the middle class who are increasingly being left behind, and nor are we connecting them with those difficult problems that I've mentioned. And that's part of the greed in my title when I talk about need, speed, and greed. I'm really talking about harnessing not the greed is good capitalism of Gordon Gekko, but moving towards a harnessing greed for good so that we reward innovators that work on socially difficult and important problems.
You cover a lot of territory. I'm curious about the influence of innovation and where it actually comes from. You write in your book that more than half of humankind now lives in urban areas. That's a huge shift, right?
It's a big trip. It's really the first time in human history. We crossed this line a couple of years ago, and China just crossed this in the last 2 months, where the lion's share of their society and now humanity live in cities, in urban areas. And we know the trend line. Within 20, 30 years, we may be at 70% of humanity. And this poses enormous challenges, obviously, but it's also, I argue, an enormous opportunity. That's because when people are clustered more closely together, for one thing, if we do things right, we can actually leapfrog to systems that are more energy efficient. Because when you have a disparate population, by definition, it's harder to get resources and you may be more wasteful. We have an opportunity to do things more efficiently. But also, studies from Jeffrey West at the Santa Fe Institute, one of our great centers of blue sky thinking in America, argue that the cities are really clusters of innovation. And at least his research shows that people who live in cities are orders of magnitude more creative and more innovative than their country bumpkin cousins. Now, you can argue with the data and methodology, but the point is there that increasingly the crucibles of innovation are going to be the cities, the mega cities, particularly of the developing world. And I say that we need to harness this power. We need to do it smartly. We can't let it happen willy-nilly. But there is something wonderful happening. And there is every chance that we're about to enter a new golden age of innovation. It's not the first time in human history, obviously. If there had been no innovation, we would still be living like the Stone Ages, right? So, but it happens in bursts once in a while. The great Victorian Age of Invention 130 years ago laid the foundation stones for 20th century progress, things like grid electrification, modern chemistry, confluence of gasoline and the internal combustion engine that powered American greatness in the 20th century. Well, we're at that kind of foundational moment where many trends are coming, but there are new tools of innovation that are emerging, and there are new rules about how innovation itself happens, and that's really what I talk about in the book. We need to learn these if we are going to keep up and if we are to prosper rather than perish.
And you talk about the emerging economies. You mentioned China and India. Are there pluses and minuses to these economies that are booming there as well?
Well, I think if you ask anyone in the heartland of America, they'll largely list the minuses, right? The popular
jobs are going there.
Right. They're sucking away our jobs, and cheap stuff made there doesn't really help us. But in fact, they've become innovation powerhouses, and America's lost its innovation mojo. If you believe some of the political candidates that are on the stump, they argue that China's rise means America has to come down. Well, again, part of what I want to do with this book is debunk some of these myths. Innovation is not a zero-sum game when you look across all of history. Japan's rise 30 years ago was denounced by most politicians and even some economists. But in fact, what we saw was Japan's rise was peaceful, and it was perfectly consistent with America getting much more prosperous in the meanwhile. Innovation can be, and China's rise, I predict, will be a rising tide that's going to lift many boats. But it'll only lift those boats where you patch the holes in the vessel first. And in America, we have some work to do with our vessel when it comes to innovation and being able to take advantage of that rising tide. In areas like, for example, education, infrastructure, we need to do much better when we think about immigration policy, for example, where we've turned our back on the things that have typically made us great in the innovation space.
I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. Today, my guest is Vijay Vaitheeswaran. His book is Need, Speed, and Greed, How the New Rules of Innovation Can Transform Businesses, Propel Nations to Greatness, and Tame the World's Most Wicked Problems. Many people argue that capitalism promotes and rewards innovation, but you're not so sure.
Well, actually, what I argue is that we need more capitalism, not less, but we need a better kind of capitalism. I think the backlash against the Wall Street crisis has actually led to throwing the baby out with the bathwater to some degree. In America, we see some of this with an expansion of the state and the Occupy Wall Street movement. In Europe, it's even stronger with industrial policy, which harkens back to the 1970s, where government is picking strategic winners. A genuine example here, the French government has declared toy making to be a strategic industry and is subsidizing French toy makers.
Okay.
So there we go. And of course, in places like China, state capitalism is on the rise, where the government really dominates the economy through subsidized credit. They own the banks. They direct capital to favored state-run industries, much to the expense of the private sector, entrepreneurs, and even to foreign companies. And a lot of times, intellectual property rights are seized or, in effect, coerced out of foreigners. And so their view of innovation is not consistent with capitalism at all, in my view. What I argue is that if we really want to innovate, and if we are going to have that more ambitious, more disruptive, more democratic vision of innovation that I think is necessary, if we're going to tame these wicked problems, we need to actually encourage solutions from the bottom up. And that can be through traditional capitalist means, meaning private sector entrepreneurs. But a lot of what I talk about in the book are social entrepreneurs, that is, people with hybrid business models, people who are working in novel ways, trying to connect philanthrocapitalism, that is, money given by charities perhaps, but actually using business models, incentives, so that the actual delivery of social goods is done in a sustainable way.
So it's good for everybody, but you also argue that it needs to be good for the entrepreneur and the innovator as well. They need to get paid. Otherwise, they're probably not going to do it, right?
Absolutely. I think that the right appeal for society is that we actually need to provide innovators with greater rewards. And this is where, in a sense, the greed part of my argument comes in. This isn't going to be done through altruism. It isn't going to get done by government fiat. The solutions will emerge emerge from the bottom up, but we need to actually provide much greater incentives for entrepreneurs that work towards a social good, and even in terms of looking at sectors. If you look at something like healthcare, where we spend almost 20% of our GDP, look at where the incentives are lined up. It's a huge number of incentives in the system. I would call them perverse incentives for treatment after you get sick, for having ever more expensive scans and, you know, sort of swim-through MRIs, the latest innovation that costs a lot of money but doesn't really add much value.
You're not sure if those things are actually helping people?
I think there's a very dubious additional value to lots of things that we do in healthcare. In contrast, what are the incentives for prevention? Right, and when this is a role for government, for us to come together as society and to set incentives for
the
market.
But the MRI is a huge innovation. Isn't that a great innovation?
Thank you for asking, because I actually think the word innovation is the most abused word in the English language.
Which I'm happy to abuse today.
Yes, well, I want to take you to test. Innovation is not invention. And I think it's often mischievously conflated by companies that want to make a lot of money in the marketplace, but also I think confused by well-intentioned, say, government bureaucrats or scientific societies. Because when I talk about innovation, I don't mean technology. I mean, my book is not really about technology at all. But most people, when you say innovation, they say, you mean patents or IP or intellectual property rights or, you know, gadgets, gizmos. In my view, that has very little to do with the innovation. Innovation is fresh thinking, which may or may not involve technology, that creates value. In other words, you have to create something valuable for customers. It could be for shareholders. It could be for society if you're a government that's innovating. And there is good evidence that governments are beginning to do things in some places in what I would consider more innovative ways through data transparency and so OpenGov. There are ways to do this, but then it could be for citizens. So fresh thinking that creates value, the harder part of that process is creating value. It's not actually coming up with the technology.
Well, and you argue that when we create the technology and then the healthcare costs go up because we have to pay for using all these great new toys, that may not always be a better thing.
Exactly. And this gets back to your prior question, you know, what are the pluses and minuses of the Chinas and Indias coming up? I actually posit that though there are some negative consequences, of course, of having new industries emerge in other countries, the rise of disruptive innovators, the frugal engineers of China and India in healthcare could actually end up saving the American healthcare system. This could be good for Americans. And here's how. Medical innovation has come to be in a bizarro world where innovation has come to mean a lot more expensive and just a little bit better. Think about your cell phone or any other device, your car, you know, laptop, anything else we think of as an innovative product. Every year they come out with a product that's typically cheaper, smaller, and much better. That's what innovation should mean, but not in medical devices or technology, right? It's almost like a defense industry. It's a cost-plus model. Whatever they come up with, basically we end up buying. And one hospital has it, everyone else has it. If your friend had a certain kind of technology, you're like, oh, yeah, I want that scan too. What these inventive companies out of China and India are coming up with is frugal approaches where they come up with cheap and cheerful devices and that are actually sometimes cheaper and a lot better. And one small example, with ultrasound, for example, there's a Chinese company called Mindray. They're actually listed on the New York Stock Exchange now, but 20 years ago, they were nothing. They're a couple of guys. And they said, wait a minute, why are these companies that we work for, they worked for some of the big boys, and they said, why are they making such expensive products? We can't afford them in China. They tried to get them to make cheaper, more affordable products. The company said, no, we're not interested. So they did it themselves. And they made ultrasound products. At the time, they said everyone wanted to go to color because that was the big gizmo, very expensive. They said, no. Keep it black and white, but why don't we add digital technology and make it smaller so it's more portable, affordable? And guess what? They came up with something that's actually cheaper and better because it's digital, and they are now world number one in their segment. And I think that's – and including in the U.S., that's the kind of disruptive innovation that's coming to healthcare. My argument is the disruptive innovation is going to save American healthcare. The only question is, will the disruptive innovator use forks or chopsticks?
We're going to take a break in just a moment, although I do want to finish up with healthcare for a moment because you talked with Paul Yock, who is head of the Biodesign Lab at Stanford University, regarding healthcare innovation. What did he have to say?
He is leading the charge in America to challenge this idea of how we do medical innovation as simply gold plating the next generation of fancy devices. So he's training, and he's a wonderful, influential leader in the academic world. He's training generation of medical designers to start with customer needs first. Don't design an elegant gadget that is technically perfect and then go looking for a use. So, you know, you invent a new hammer, all you're going to do is go look for nails, right?
Right.
He says, no, go and understand your consumer, meaning the patients. And once you figure out what they need, then come back and design just what's needed frugally. And he's actually set up shop in India, and his students exchange lessons, because being in a place like India, and like you could substitute Brazil or China or a number of these emerging economies, where there's a big enough middle class that people can afford stuff and also demand high quality. But at the same time, they remember what it is to be poor. And they say, we're not going to overpay for stuff. So come up with things that would reach the broad masses, make it frugal. I think this is really the new consumption. It's not conspicuous consumption. It's elegant frugality.
I'm speaking with Vijay Vaitheeswaran from The Economist. His latest book is Need, Speed, and Greed: How the New Rules of Innovation Can Transform Businesses, Propel Nations to Greatness, and Tame the World's Most Wicked Problems. It's published by Harper Business, and we'll have more after a break. Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate today. My guest is Vijay Vaitheeswaran. He's newly been named the China Business and Finance Editor of The Economist. His new book is called Need, Speed, and Greed. We've been experiencing a significant economic recession for the past few years. It seems to be turning around just a little bit. Is an economic slowdown harmful for innovation?
I actually think that it creates a real opportunity. I think good companies invest in a downturn. That's a history of lots of great corporations. And during the Great Depression, for example, lots of companies were founded. Lots of business models were perfected. Avon, for example, was founded during the recession at that time. And I think that what we need to see right now, this downturn, as a real opportunity to invest in the drivers of long-term growth. That's why I argue, and in fact, I was on Capitol Hill on Friday on behalf of a number of the leading scientific societies in America, arguing for increasing investment in federal R&D, because I think there is an important role for government, a circumscribed role, not picking technology winners and solar companies and so on, but investing in the enablers of future growth, like blue sky research, that only the government would fund, the market wouldn't. We need to do that in a downturn. We need to keep investing in education, for example. So the drastic cuts we're doing in some of the state universities across the U.S. to me actually are quite heartbreaking, because when you make cuts in these things as opposed to, say, entitlement programs, what you actually find is that you reduce the longer-term rate of growth for the economy, and so you actually hurt future innovation and our capacity to innovate. And let's be clear about this. Our economy is entering a much more difficult period. Developed economies generally are entering an era of what's been called frontier economics. The easy gains, the low-hanging fruit, have already been picked. It's going to be a lot harder for us to grow going forward. And part of the reason for this is, you know, we are now in the ideas economy. 80% of America's GDP comes not from brawn, but from using our brain. And that's going to only grow. And that means we have to change how we educate our children, how we learn during our full careers as well.
But can we grow at the same rate? You know, and it's hard in an election year, because everybody says it's all about growth, growth, growth. But there's talk about the fact that maybe there's a leveling off. Maybe we can't expect this kind of growth. And no president has been reelected with under 7.2 unemployment. That maybe that will happen in the future. Is that possible?
You know, there has been this argument, and Tyler Cohen, an economist, has argued we have actually entered a great stagnation, and that America's long-term growth rates are diminished. I challenge that thesis in my book. And I say, actually, it's true. We have not grown as quickly as we had hoped. But the drivers of productivity will be innovation. And Ben Bernanke actually gave an important speech about this, where he said, for the first time from officialdom, that we live in an innovation economy, and the intangibles, as they're called, that is, the knowledge networks, that what's in our head at the end of the day, when people at WNYC or at Google, when your employees leave, you actually take most of the value of your organization out the door, but it's not actually reflected on the balance sheets. And so we need to think about how we even account for value in an innovation information economy. And if we account for this properly, we're actually a much wealthier country than China, for example. It's not catching up as quickly as people claim. So I'm a big believer that we can understand and drive this growth, but if we need to get better at understanding the tools of innovation and how the new rules themselves are changing.
Let's broaden this to the global picture. One of the things that triggered the Arab Spring in the Middle East was that there's a lot of young people, and a lot of them are out of work. How can we address that?
Some people say the world's difficulties are going to be made worse because of a population bomb. You know, that's a term that was made popular in the 70s by Paul Ehrlich, a thinker at Stanford. I think that's fundamentally the wrong way to think about this. People are a resource. What we need to do is make sure that people are empowered and able to contribute and take advantage of the innovation process. If we think of the world as 7 billion innovators in waiting, then we actually have greater hope, more possibilities to solve our problems. And what I show is that the democratization of innovation that's now happening actually gives more hope that we can drive future business models, for example, that come from the bottom up. When more people are connected with the ways of solving problems, we actually have more ability to solve them. One concrete example, connecting back to America and our own future productivity growth. Some people say that manufacturing is dead in America. You know, famously, we had NAFTA and the sucking sound and then China's rise. Well, guess what? Actually, I think there's every reason to think we may see a revival of manufacturing in America, but we may have to redefine what manufacturing means. A story I've written just recently in The Economist shows through all the numbers and frontline reporting why we're actually at the end of cheap China. China itself has tapped out the ability to be the workshop to the world at extremely low prices and wage increases, the middle class there demanding environmental regulations, all things that are actually good for Americans, I think. You know, the stuff we buy at Walmart might cost a couple of pennies more, but it is, but the fact that China's wage rates are going up by so much gives us a fighting chance to enter the manufacturing space, but not with the low-end jobs. We're talking about the next generation of manufacturing. And this is where there's an exciting revolution happening with, for example, 3D printing, with computer-aided design, much more sophisticated tools, things that used to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, Marx was right in this, that, you know, the tools of production, the means of production, were in the hands of a few capitalists. Why? You needed millions of dollars to own a factory. But with this new age that's coming, we're actually seeing a democratization of the very tools of manufacturing. There's a company called Tech Shop where, you know, basically like you go to Kinko's to use fancy photocopiers, right, or print out in color, you can go and use the cutting-edge 3D printing machine, Autodesk software to design a new iPad case and have it printed that normally you would have had to own your own factory to do. You can, for $100 a month, you can be a member there and the price is going to drop. That's the kind of thing that's democratizing manufacturing, I think, can actually lead to a renaissance in America.
Elliot Forrest here, and for Leonard Lopate, my guest is Vijay Vaitheeswaran. His book is Need, Speed, and Greed, How the New Rules of Innovation Can Transform Businesses, Propel Nations to Greatness, and Tame the World's Most Wicked Problems. Even my own vision of the American dream has changed in the sense that my son, for example, is 17. Years ago, I probably would have thought, I hope he gets a good job and he sticks with it for a long time. Now it's just, I hope he comes up with an app. I mean, that's where I see the innovation, and I don't think I'm alone.
No, I think – exactly. And I think today it may be an app, but we can't even predict what it's going to be 20, 30 years from now, right? And that's part of why I'm excited. I think, you know, the problems are real. Acknowledge them. That's the need part of need, speed, and greed. But when you actually say, you know, even 5 years ago, who would have predicted that a field like synthetic biology could end up solving the climate change crisis, right? That's a field that didn't even exist. But Craig Venter, a pioneer in genomics, who was the man who invented life, that is the field of synthetic biology, very famously a couple of years ago, is betting his farm that he's going to come up with a solution to the clean energy problem using synthetic biology. If he does, it will make all of our politics over Solyndra and funding nuclear versus solar, it'll make them irrelevant. I think, and that's the kind of thing we can't actually predict, because the technologies that are arising now, as I mentioned, this is a golden age of invention. They're not only exponentially rising, they're actually converging in unexpected ways and making new industries possible.
Well, what are your thoughts on the politics getting in the way? Because sometimes just the innovation is made fun of. The idea of these things get poo-pooed because we need to stick to the old ways.
I think there is a real problem there. And one example we can give is genetic modification, right? GMOs, these were hugely unpopular, in part because they were championed by a company, Monsanto, that attached them to a business model that, in effect, made it impossible for small, poor farmers in developing countries to get seeds unless they went back to Monsanto, right? So it was the business model that people particularly objected to. But attached to that were relatively unscientific concerns from environmental groups that said, oh, this is going to, in effect, wipe out the ecosystem. So what do we have? We have an anti-science approach to something that could actually radically transform agricultural productivity in places like Africa. The only way we're going to be able to feed a world of 9 billion people, which we will be at soon, is if we improve agricultural productivity and keep an open mind to experimentation, to science done the right way. And I'm against the Monsanto business model, and I say so in my book, because it was a particularly greedy business model. But to be against genetic modification or in other kinds of improvements in agricultural productivity on the basis of what one company's greed, as it were, right, I think is to miss the greater opportunity. So I say we need to be open to science, technology, and in fact, we need to become much more literate as a society in science and technology.
You talked to so many people for this book. Economist Paul Romer was part of your book as well. What did you hear from him?
Well, you know, he's really one of the great thinkers when it comes to innovation. He has shown and led a group of thinkers known as the sort of the new growth theorists that have shown that ideas are really what create the most value in the economy. For a long time, it may sound crazy, but people thought land, labor, capital, you know, the old-fashioned ways of thinking about economics, this is what created value. Increasingly, the theories that he and his people have put forward show that it's ideas. And when you think about a world of ideas creating value, then you suddenly see why the thinking that thinks that growth is limited, that we resources are scarce, that we have to imagine that there are limits to growth, to invoke the name of a camp of thinkers from the 1970s that predicted that the world would run out of food, would run out of oil. Well, guess what? By the year 2000, well, we didn't run out of any of those things because they misunderstood the role of innovation. It can be messy. It involves creative destruction. You know, when we started to run out of a certain resource or commodity, it does lead to scarcity. But development is a dynamic dance. It's not a static picture. So what you have is price signals go up, markets respond, people may substitute other kinds of resources, companies will invest to bring more resources online. It's that dynamic dance that leads to new outcomes. A small example here. Back in 1950, granite in Vermont was pretty worthless. It was tombstone material, didn't cost much. By 1980, it became incredibly precious and cost a lot of money. The difference in that interim was that the civilian nuclear industry had taken off. It turned out those rocks had uranium in them. And I use that example because it shows that it's hard to argue limits to growth when the very definition of resources changes over time because of innovation. I think that's really the right way to think about the future.
Can you talk about innovation in education? I know this is talked about a great deal. What's the best model that you see?
I think if I were to put it in one sentence, we need to keep relearning how to learn. The way that the tools of education are changing, the way that the innovation economy is changing, we can't rely, for example, for our children, putting them into an educational system and expecting, as one might have in 1950, let's say, you send your kids off to good public schools, and I'm a product of public schools and proud of it, and expect that somehow you're going to get a good education, you'll get along fine in life. As parents, we have to take ownership of our children's education much more so than it was in the past, in part because our model of education, which was suited to the Industrial Revolution, is a sort of a one-size-fits-all approach and produces more or less a commodity education. And we haven't yet embraced across the system. And there are always exceptions and pockets of innovation. But I'm saying if you look across the system, we haven't figured out that in an ideas economy, what matters is not memorization, standardization, harmonization, you know, all the things that the tiger mom phenomena right. put on top, you know, that you need to have discipline and that's better than play, that you need to have, you know, memorization that's somehow better than creativity, and you need to have sort of deference for authority and that's better than dissent. I say rubbish. That's exactly the wrong way to prepare children for the innovation economy. Yes, of course, we all need to know reading, writing, arithmetic, but that's the minimum price of entry for the 21st century economy. You know, I say that disruptive dads will beat tiger moms any day, and that what we really need is to teach sort of the creative destruction.
Talk about the concept of open innovation, what that is and how you see that as valuable.
Well, this is one of the really big trends, the ways in which innovation itself is changing, sort of, you know, what I call meta-innovation. That's a powerful new thing we really need to understand. In the old model of innovation through the 20th century, it would be corporate silos like, you know, Xerox PARC or AT&T Bell Labs.
And closed doors and very secret.
That's right. They used to keep their patents very close to their chest, and sort of gray beards wearing white coats would be aspiring to Nobel Prizes. And they came up with wonderful things, right? This is a model that worked for its time and place. But as we saw, you know, it's not only a few people that go to Caltech and Harvard and NYU, let's say, or the pillars of academic excellence are the ones who are coming up with great ideas. We have great universities around the world. And frankly, a lot of people who don't go to university are clever inventors, are creative, and are now connected to a democratic process of innovation. So innovation is now an open, networked, even user-generated and driven approach. And so the smartest people in your company don't work for you any longer. You'd better connect with them. And if you don't do it, your rivals are going to do it.
So you're a fan of crowdsourcing, as sometimes unpredictable and incorrect as sometimes it might be?
Well, you know, crowdsourcing is great, but I take on a couple of myths about crowdsourcing. People like to talk about the wisdom of crowds, and it's very fashionable. You know, you go on Amazon and the comments are great, and I use that to buy products, and companies now use crowdsourcing. But I say, hang on a minute, you know, crowdsourcing can sometimes lead to a bland mediocrity or even a stupidity of crowds, right? So just because you are going to use sort of open source or open innovation methods doesn't mean you can like sack your entire in-house R&D team. And,
right. Or not be skeptical.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, we have power users that kind of take over websites, and sometimes they have an agenda, right? So what you actually need is you need to think of your company as a beacon. That means bright enough on the inside, smart enough with good people and knowledge, you can actually attract the best partners that you can work with, but also, you know, smart enough and skeptical enough to call BS on crowdsourcing that produces
what it
rubbish.
Is. Actually, one of the best ideas I've seen this year, Forvo. Do you know what Forvo is?
It's such a simple idea.
Imagine a website like Wikipedia, except for pronunciations, in that everybody on the planet can come in and say, this is how you pronounce something. It's completely crowdsourced. It's a really brilliant idea. You write in your book that the world has become a more dangerous place. How is innovation going to help that or slow that?
I think in some ways we just need to look at the tsunami in Japan and the earthquake. We just commemorated the one-year anniversary of that. Among the things that happened was the global supply chain was dramatically disrupted by this, and in ways that people hadn't expected. Not just because, you know, iPad deliveries were held up. That was very traumatic for some tech nerds.
Right. But,
you know,
but there were worse things.
There were worse things. And same with the Icelandic volcano, which also radically disrupted global supply chains. We are interconnected in ways that we don't even understand, and we haven't fully accounted for some of the vulnerabilities and fragilities. So what I argue for is actually that we need to have greater resilience built into our systems. Sometimes that means thinking about insurance, and which might mean paying a little more right now. Or as we think about building the cities of the future or the infrastructure of the future, building in smart learning systems, and that builds in more resilience. In a world with climate change, with greater pandemics, with fragile supply lines that are ever more interlinked, I think we have to really think about that resilience. The way I put it, the black swan will kill the sitting duck.
I've been speaking with Vijay Vaitheeswaran about his latest book, Need, Speed, and Greed, How the New Rules of Innovation Can Transform Businesses, Propel Nations to Greatness, and Tame the World's Most Wicked Problems. It's published by Harper Business. Thank you so much for being in today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.